have a quiz you can take while we're going to, but I'm going to not take the time on that. I've got some introductory stuff. Remember, we have these projects, and we'll start on those on Sunday. And so I hope, I think I would like to start this B first. We'll start because I've done a little more work on that. And there's a worksheet, but let me show you what our resources are.
All right, teachers, can I step you for a minute? We never got that first sheet.
The instructions.
Yeah, I'm going to show you how to get that.
Thank you.
In fact, I'm going to show you how to get lots of stuff here.
Oh.
Okay, so this is our Facebook page. You're probably aware of that. It's actually the home page, and I can't see what I'm doing because I have an extended screen.
You want to drop down to the current.
Yeah, so if you look here, this study of Deuteronomy, all the slides are here up through, not today, but I mean, because I just made some of these a few minutes ago, but all the way up till last Sunday. All the lessons are here, the worksheet in PDF form, and the worksheet in PowerPoint. So if you want to, like, edit it, which is what I did is, of course it opened on this other screen. What I did is I opened up my favorite Bible app, Bible Gateway, where I can do searches and things like that. I can do keyword searches for stuff. And you can just type right in this lesson sheet if you want to. After you enable editing, of course.
And you can copy and paste.
Oh, yes, you can do that if you want to do verses. And, you know, the table's a little bit unwieldy. As you type stuff in, it self-sizes, which means your lines will go off the bottom. But don't worry about that. Just, you know, go to another page. So you can edit the worksheet if you want, and you get to the lessons. And so back to this page. So these are all the lessons up through 11. There's no lesson 12 except what y'all prepare for Sunday. And then the slides up till Sunday are there. All this thanks to Jason Reynolds, and you see him. I mean, I package him.
I don't know that he's updated. If you go,
it's on the homepage only right now.
Right.
So if you go back to where all the resources are and go to adult classes, this long alphabetical list, it's not there, but it's right here. The word is near you, right? You don't have to go across the sea or go up and ascend to heaven or down to the depths. It's right there.
Which particular lesson that's in there has those lists of assignments?
It's actually in the slides. It's in the slides.
Oh, in the slides.
I know, but it tells you which lesson.
I'm sorry, what?
What would be this
lesson? Lesson one?
It's probably way down. I think I put them in Sundays just so you can go to the very bottom.
Okay.
And there it is right there. In fact,
that's the example.
I know, but there's the worksheet and there's the projects.
Okay.
So, but, and I actually started doing it just to see if it was hard to do or not. What's that?
Is that group two's answers?
Some of them. They might be made up, though.
So you like group two better?
All right. So now
so Wednesday is going to be group one.
Wednesday will be group one. But actually, it wouldn't hurt to do all of them, I suppose. So that's a better picture of the one that's already in there as an example. Okay. We'll do this quickly. Genesis in the beginning, who is God? Holiness of God, faithfulness of God, God's gift to Israel, and where we are tonight. If you're listening to the tape, I'm on slide 77. But we're in this very last section. Remember, there's history, and then there's kind of more history on the end. Although this looks backward, and this is kind of present and looking forward, we'll actually see how the Song of Moses gets us into the future as well. So there's this chiastic structure, and we started the review of history, and we're ending with a change in leadership and look ahead. Remember, the central part was this. Central core was the stipulations of the covenant or further explanation of the law. That was 12 to 26. I think you ought to know the chapters that are like the core of that. And you probably should know 1 through 4 and like 30 through 34 kind of as the end pieces of that too. So that's a way to do that. Or 31 through 32. I just want to go back to 30. Now, 31 was mostly discussion of Joshua's succession from Moses. And I think Bill made a good, you know, brought out pretty well. What we're looking at there is that really it shouldn't matter who the human leader is. That if God's our leader, the human leader, and now that character may influence in some way, but if they go away, and God's plan is that all leaders die, that's the way they are. It may even be his plan that all leaders sometimes make a mistake.
Did it happen with Moses? Yeah. So the point is, be prepared for that, for both their removal, for both their mistakes, and our dependence should be on God. That's maybe an implicit message. But back to chapter 30, there was a section about the accessibility in verses 11 through 14. I just want to make a key point about that, because I think it pervades the book as a theme, but it really comes out as we prepare for the Song of Moses, especially in its prophetic nature. Moses says this: "This is the commandment I give you today. It's not too mysterious, nor is it far off. It's not in heaven, that you should say, 'Who will ascend to heaven and bring it to us?' And to hear it and do it. Nor is it beyond the sea, you should say, 'Who will go over the sea and bring it to us?' And we may hear it and do it. But the word is very near you, in your mouth and in your heart, that you may do it."
Why was it in their mouth? In what sense was it in their mouth? What does that mean?
They're just saying it.
They can say it. These are words that they can articulate in song or in text or reading or whatever. And we'll see this great emphasis on this repeating of things. It's written in words. And of course, Paul makes a point of that in Romans 10 to say the gospel is that way too. Is that a contrast from the way most people view religion? And I was going to say today, but I think of all time. Right? How do you get the truth of the great unknown or the great, you know, nirvanas? Where do you get that stuff? Do you read it and kind of explain it to someone?
Usually some kind of outside, sentient, spiritual.
So it could be this kind of mystical thing where it just kind of gets poured into me in some emotional way. Or it could be there's a leader, like we just talked about, but not a leader, but a prophet, guru, right? And he's the only one that can get it to you, but you kind of have to go to him. What happens here is, as Moses dies, is like their access to God gone away.
Yeah.
That's the whole point of the book, isn't it? What are we writing it for? Why am I telling you this for? Because I'm not going to be here, and it'll be there. In fact, he even says, this word will be a witness against you. Remember that? They wrote it, and this is going to sit up there on those white tables of stone, and when you go do bad, God and all of heaven and earth, we're going to see in chapter 32 of me, will point to that and say, here's the witness, these words. Now, what's interesting, you probably have been in the worldview class, there's a word for that kind of truth, where I can state it, you can read it, you can understand it, even if you don't believe it, even if you reject it, even if you trample on it, which we're going to see that imagery in this text, it still means the same thing. There's a word for that. You remember what we had that word for? You might remember. Okay, well, we kind of made it up in a way that it's propositional. What that means is, I can put that truth forward, independent of me, and independent of you, and lay it down between us, and we can both look at it and understand the same thing about it. It's readable and so on. Now, that doesn't mean either of us believe it, really, but it's something we can communicate. It's not better felt than told inside of me. It's not subjectively discerned by somebody else, or what does it mean to you, different from what it means to this other person. You just see that theme all through this, and that is not only this accessibility to God, but this propositional form, that it's either true or false, right? Either way, you can understand it, and it's written in words, and the words themselves carry the message, not some a spiritual experience or some God-enabled thing. Am I making sense? I hope you'll see that theme as we go through. And what that means is, when you look at texts like, this is the introduction to the song, which is in 32, the Song of Moses, which we're going to read in a minute. But as an introduction in 31, he's like getting ready to tell it. And the reason is, because I'm about to die, right? But he says Moses wrote the law, he delivered it to the priests. Do you see that? It was physical form. They could put it somewhere. In the ark, or by the ark, however that was, I'm not real clear. Not only that, every 7 years, everyone's reading, even children who don't know much, 7 years older, you know, or whatever, hadn't even heard it before. Right? It's read in their hearing, and they can hear it, and that they may learn it, right? And they can observe it and know it and hear it and learn it. You see all these words, wrote and taught and writing in the words of this book as a witness. I'm telling you, I think that sets the true religion apart from almost all others. It's all unchangeably written down in, I'm going to say the word again, propositional form. Am I overkilling that point? But I think it just keeps pouring through here.
in these things here. Once again, in chapter 31, we're not yet to the psalm. Write down the psalm. Teach it. Put it in their mouths. That's what we saw before. It's in your mouth. Why? How'd they get there? Well, they just learned it and they could say it. That this song may be a witness for me against the children of Israel, right? And when many evils have come against them, this song will testify. The song will testify, right? The words themselves, as a witness, in the mouths of the descendants. Therefore, Moses wrote it, he taught it to the children, he spoke it in the hearing of the words. So you get the idea. That's kind of where we're headed. Now, it's not just in chapter 32, although this is probably the best example, you know, but the whole text is that same way. Okay, and I'm going to go back to chapter 4 because remember we're in a kind of chiastic structure. What's happening at the end is kind of also what happened at the beginning of the book. And notice what he said about the whole law. Listen to the statutes which I teach you. Keep them. I taught you. You act according to them. You observe them. You hear. Y'all see that I'm reading the blue words here. Yeah. Hear them. Say them, right? And then he kind of says, there's something different about you than any other nation in the world. What great nation is there that has such statutes and righteous judgments as are in this law that are set before you? You see the difference? I think he's contrasting this approach to all other world religions. It's just written down. The whole world can read it if they want to. This is your wisdom. It sets you apart from your religion. I think that's what he's saying. I think that's the way God's plan was to address our minds with words that are propositional. Not only that, how does the next generation get it? Well, same way. They just get taught that. And of course, chapter 6 goes on with more details about that. Okay, chapter 32. Yes, please. You can ask a long question, but I'll have a short answer.
It's not unlike the propositional, but you know how you referenced that they were supposed to have it written before them? Do you think if that was just the Ten Commandments, or do you think that was all Deuteronomy, or like how much could they write on the stone?
Yeah, so I think the white stones was probably some subset of laws. I don't know, it just didn't seem like a lot of stones.
Right.
But I do think somewhere there was a book. There's a reference to a book here in this chapter.
That they would have set aside the ark plus the other.
Right. Okay. And the other thing was, I think the kings were commanded to make their own copy. By the way, a book was a very precious thing. A lot of materials went into building up that many pages. So why not give you a bunch of them? That may explain why they had to just... Everybody read it all of it every 7 years, right? And maybe this one copy, that's all there was so far, was actually put beside the ark in a precious place and protected. I guess in the synagogue, you know, there's similar practices now where they'll have some ancient copy of the Torah. It might be 100 years old. But, you know, it'd be in some kind of special container, put up near the front and only pulled out at certain times. Kind of dates back to that.
At least the stone... that they found at Shechem, which may not be the stone at Ebal. There's a little distance there. I mean, that was a pretty good size, Steve. That was a pretty good size stone.
And small letters.
And small letters, and done on plaster. I mean, well, so they found, like, the prophecies of Balaam, and that was some pretty small writing on that.
So maybe the whole thing.
Could have been on that one, at least possible.
Yeah, I don't really know the answer to that question. But I will change the subject since I don't. There's, I think, a kind of a reasonable picture here, too, of how God intended for the canon to be formed here. That's just the beginning of writing, of God's writing. But you see what's happening here? Did Moses confirm his authority to write this stuff in some way? We're going to see that in chapter 34. Was there a confirmation of Moses' authority? Probably about the best there ever was, like a mountain shaking and stuff like that, and God's voice and all that kind of thing. And when he wrote it, he said, you know, this is it. And go store it and protect it. And that's the way it worked. And so now that's one book. Is it all the books God was ever going to write? No. After a little while, there'd be another one added. In fact, it may be that chapter 34 was added a few years later. We'll look at the dating of that and some evidence in the chapter for that. But I just think when a book got written by God's guidance, that it just was added to the so-called canon, I didn't really call it that, but it's to the body of inspired work. The same thing with the prophets. But anyway, I think that's the beginning of this picture here, where Moses saying, here it is, write it, protect it, read it. Okay, so looking at chapter 32, I kept looking for larger structures in this. We'll do a few fun things. I hope you find them fun, but here's the story generally. Some have said this is a little like a lawsuit. It starts with a statement of the qualifications or the innocence of the what's the person, plaintiff, sorry, I can't think of that word, the one who's bringing the complaint against the, who's the offended person. And then in contrast, Israel's unrighteousness. A look back in the days of old, then there's a protection of Israel when they're in their childhood, a provision for their prosperity, which I think is describing the promised land, but we can have that argument when we get there. Jeshurun, which is apparently a kind of a nickname for Israel. It's only used in about 2-3 places. It means upright one. And some people think it's like a diminutive. It'd be like William, who might be called Billy. But I think it may be more of an ironic name, where it is a nickname, but he's called, it almost has the word Asher in it. But it's the idea of being upright, and it's maybe some irony in saying, oh, upright one or something. We don't
like when the big fat guy's named Tiny.
Yeah, exactly. Something like that. Yeah. So anyway, you can kind of see where it's used and determine if that's the way it works or not. And then there's God's jealous anger because of their rebellion and forgetfulness, God's punishment, and then an abbreviation of his punishment. Remember that? He said, I should have just wiped you out, but I was afraid that the enemies would look at that and think that somehow or another I was weak or something. And then Israel, lack of wisdom. And then God takes vengeance on the enemies. I think the very ones who brought about this punishment. It's the idea there, a little bit of a Habakkuk in that, perhaps, and that is they punish him, but God takes vengeance on them. And in connection with that, he shows mercy once his people realize that they're at the bottom. They have no place, there's no power. Once they admit that, then he has mercy on them. His power and justice are shown, and then finally there's this rejoicing for God's vengeance and atonement. And who else is rejoicing here at the end besides just the Israel who's been restored to the land? But I'll give it in the text.
Was it all nations?
Yeah, the Gentiles, or the nations is the word for Gentiles. Okay, I just want to read this because it's... I think... Is it the next chart? No, it's not. I should have put it next, but... Maybe I can. This is 82. Let me see if I can skip to the next chart here. No, that's not it. Yeah. Take a look at these images as we go through. This is a very picturesque song. There's rain and dew and raindrops and showers. The image of a rock is all through that. In fact, perhaps when he says, I'm going to tell you the name of God, and then he says Yahweh and Elohim, he's not meaning either of those. The name he wants to tell them about is rock. And you'll see that in the text. And then he keeps coming back to that theme of the rock, which has the idea of, as you know, building your house on the rock, or, you know, stability, firmness. There's father and mother in a couple places. Eagle with young, which is really cool. When we talk about that, you'll see how that's evolved since the earlier reference in Exodus about eagles. There's the fat brat. I made that one up myself. I don't know that. It's in your Bible, right? Fat brat. Yeah. I made this next one up too. Volcanic fire. But it's the idea that somewhere down in the bowels of the earth, what's the mountain in the Lord of the Rings? Mordor, yeah. The fire is burning down there.
Mount Doom.
Yeah, that's it, Mount Doom. And you can just see that when things go bad on the earth, the rain gets, if something happens, that mountain just has an earthquake, Beasts and snakes, dried poison plants, and then arrows, and speaking more of the Lord of the Rings, swords that glow when they're ready to go to work, and blood, and that's, okay, so you get the idea. Deuteronomy 32. Give ear, O heavens, and I should go back to that. What chart is this?
83.
So we'll go back to 81, maybe. And this one. So we'll work our way through this. What I'd like you to look at for, too, as we go through it, as if the meaning was not enough to look at, look at the tense of the verbs when we go through. Y'all know about, you remember grammar, where it said he led the people, what would that be?
Past.
That'd be past, where it said God is...
That'd
be present, and I shall, or I will, or I.
Future.
That's all. You see, those are. So let's look for them, just as you think about it. We'll come back a little later. Give ear, O heavens, and I'll speak. And hear, O earth, the word of my mouth. Let my teaching drop as the rain, my speech distill as the dew, as rain drops on the tender herb, as showers on the grass. For I proclaim the name of the Lord, ascribe greatness to our God. That's Elohim. He is the rock, his work is perfect, and all his ways are justice. So, name of the Lord, that's Yahweh. I hate that they just put Lord in all caps, but y'all know that means Yahweh, right? And this is New King James. And then Elohim, but I'm going to proclaim his name. Which of those two names is it? Verse 4 says, the rock. Interpolated he is, but the rock. His work is perfect. All his ways are just. A God of truth, without injustice, righteous and upright is he. And maybe that's a play that we'll come back to with the Jeshurun thing, right? The upright one. I don't know. Okay, that's God. Now look at Israel. They have corrupted themselves. What tense were we there in 1 through 3? Yeah, no, 1 through 4, I mean. What tense is that?
Present.
Yeah, it's present. But really it's a statement of quality. But still, he is, he was, and he will be. But still, that's, yeah. They have corrupted themselves. They are not as children because of their blemish. A perverse and crooked generation. Do you thus deal with the Lord, O foolish and unwise people? Is he not your father who bought you? Has he not made you and established you? What tense does that sound like? Yeah, past. Although it's their quality too. Remember the days of old. That's easy to term the tense of that, right? Because he's saying the days of old. Consider the years of many generations. Ask your father and he'll show you. Your elders, they will tell you. When the Most High divided their inheritance among the nations, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the boundaries of the peoples according to the number of the children of Israel. For the Lord's portion is his people. Jacob is the place of his inheritance. A few things to say about that. What is this? When did this dividing of the nations occur? Yeah, so Babel comes to mind, or Babel, right? But is it also the case that God's always marking out and dividing the nations and determining the bounds of their habitations, as Paul said in Acts 17? Yeah, he is. Yeah. So somebody pointed out that if you count how many different sub-nations there are in, what is it, Genesis 11, Tower of Babel, I think it is. There's 70. How many people actually came out of Egypt went down in Egypt to start with? Jacob's family. There's 70, right? I don't think that's it. But there's something that's meaning according to the number of the children of Israel. What would that be? How does God set the boundaries related to the children of Israel, the number of the children of Israel?
Each tribe.
So it could be division of the tribes, but it seems like he's inheritance to the nations, per se, and sons of Adam, everybody. Any ideas? No right or wrong here, just some likelihoods, I think.
Are you saying Noah then?
Well, it probably does include Babel, but probably includes the management of world affairs ever since, as Paul said.
You mean Daniel?
Yeah. Could look forward to what, I mean, Daniel had very similar language, yeah. Well, here's an idea, and that is what was central in God's plan for the whole history of the world, no matter where the nation was?
Salvation.
Pardon?
Salvation.
Yeah, which was going to come through what nation?
The Messiah would come
through Israel. So maybe the intent here is to say, no matter what was going on, it was all kind of organized around Israel's history and bringing things to pass in there. And you're going to see the end of the song comes back to that idea that the whole world's going to be affected by this judgment and reconciliation. So maybe that's the idea. Interesting reversal there. Jacob was going to get an inheritance, but God gets an inheritance. And what was that in verse 9? What is God's inheritance? What does he get out of it? He inherits his people. That's kind of an interesting picture. And he found him in a desert land, a wasteland, a howling wilderness. I don't think that's limited to the desert on the way to Sinai or in the wanderings. I think it's just generally a picture of somebody who's about to die, abandoned. And he kept him as the apple of his eye. As an eagle stirs up its nest, hovers over its young, spread out its wings, taking them up, carrying them on its wings. So the Lord alone led him. There was no foreign God with him. So, if you went back, I think in the lesson material, I pointed you back to one earlier reference to eagles. What was that? What did it say happened?
Bore them on the wings of eagles.
Yeah, it's kind of brief, but they bore them on wings of eagles. It's kind of a simple thing. The idea being, maybe they can't fly at all. And so they're just carried, right? Hey, does Lord of the Rings have eagles? Sorry to keep bringing that up.
anyway, but here there's something kind of strange. What is he doing in verse 11? What's the eagle doing? Is he just carrying them?
Protecting them.
Yeah, but what's it say?
Slaughtering over their young.
Stirs up his nest. Who said that? What does that mean? Why would he stir up an eagle's nest? Why would the eagle? Yeah, right, exactly. So here are these little eagles, maybe, babies, eggs, hatched, whatever. He's knocking the nest around. And he's knocking them out of the nest. Why is he knocking them out of the nest? This can't be fun for the little eagle. But you know why? He wants them to fly on their own. Now, does he leave them to crash if they don't make it? Look what he says. He hovers over them. He spreads out his wings. So there's this protective, but still, you know, as we say, leaving the nest. That's our little term for that. And we'll get to it in just a minute. But I'll just tell you, back in that lesson where we were talking about eating meat at your house, and you could have as much meat as you wanted. Remember that lesson? You didn't have to sacrifice it at the tabernacle. Long as it wasn't for worship, do it within your gates. Remember that? You can have all the meat you want. You want meat? You hadn't had it for a long time. It's all on you. You can have it. Just don't do the idolatrous worship. Bring that to the place God selects. I think that was the message of that chapter. I just started thinking, is there a time in life where that becomes an issue? Where you suddenly have the freedom to kind of like eat steak whenever you want? Or go wherever you want, or stay up as late as you want to, and it becomes a challenge in your life because now suddenly this kind of rigorous, you know, oversight that you've had is kind of taken away. And you say, you mean I can just like go to anywhere I want and eat as much as I want?
When you're empty nested, right an hour that way.
Yeah. So you're kind of downstream where I had it. Yeah. So is this coming? So I was thinking that really. And I do want to say, because I didn't feel too, like it seemed like a little bit imaginary until I read this chapter again. I was thinking, no, that's what this is happening. I think Book of Deuteronomy is very applicable to someone who's leaving home. They're leaving home for the first time. They've been under their parents. Who gave them their food? Right? Whether they really liked eating that man off the ground or not, that's what they got to eat. That's what they had to eat. There were rules, a lot of rules they had to obey. Limitations, things they wanted they couldn't have because their mom said no, you know, and stuff like that. But there comes a place where you leave the nest, and that's a dangerous time. Because that freedom is there. You now begin to see things around you. Remember that same chapter? It says, don't be curious about the religions that were here and all that. I think that's a dangerous time. But here, the image flips around, and he says, Israel's an adolescent. Right? They're birds, about they need to learn to fly. They're even kicked out of the nest. And they've had it pretty easy, right? So we'll keep reading. He made him ride in the heights of the earth. Let him use his own car. That he might eat the produce of the field. Made him to draw honey from the rock, oil from the flinty rock, curds, that's butter from cattle, milk of the flocks, fat of rams, the rams of the breed of Bashan, and goats with the choicest wheat or corn. Old King James talks about corn and wine. I'm going to come back to that. It comes back in chapter 33. And the blood of grapes, right? Okay. Now, did you notice the tense there? How's the tense been going? God worked in days of old. That's easy, right? God protected Israel in their childhood. We just read that. What tense was that? Found him, encircled ED him. All past, yeah. God provided them in the promised land, verse 13. Eating the field. Bashan, by the way, is up the northeast side of Galilee, for example. So what is that? What tense is it in this? Is this bothering you a little bit? I'm not trying to trick you. It is past tense, right? You see what's happening here? The story is zooming on past the present. The present is Moses' time here, right? Okay, verse 15, keep reading. But Jeshurun, the upright one, grew fat and kicked. And that literally means stomp. Like the idea that he's, you know, maybe stomping on the law, perhaps. You grew fat. What tense, by the way?
You are grown fat.
Yeah. What about those? The next one? What's the next one say?
Then
what?
We go to pass.
Then you forsook the Lord
God. That's
right. It's
Mark, real quick, how do you know that 13 and 14 are about the promised land?
I don't accept the reference to the wheat and wine always is reference to the promised land. In fact, look over here, chapter 33, verse 28. Israel shall dwell, and now we're back to future, and we feel better about that, right? Shall dwell in safety, the fountain of Jacob, the land of grain and new wine, same references, the wheat and wine. Bashan, as I mentioned, is in the northeast side of Galilee, so it's part of their inheritance. I mean, it's the butter and the all that. Maybe it's figurative, but it seems like it's like, this is what you're looking for. This is, but still, it's past tense. Yeah.
Is there any indication that they got to eat any of the stuff while they were in the wilderness, too? Like, didn't they only have quail?
Yeah, I think that's the point. They didn't have meat. You know,
so even the wine.
Yeah,
like,
that's right.
And wine or
right. But they're going to the vineyards. They didn't plant. All that is coming. But I'm not trying to confuse you, but I'm making a point here. Verse 19 to 22. Oh, I'm sorry, we didn't finish reading that. Jeshua grew fat. You're covered with fat. You forsook the Lord. You scornfully esteemed the rock of your salvation. There's our word. It occurs about five times in here. They provoked him to jealousy with foreign gods. Past or present or future? Past. Is he describing events that took place in the future? It's hard to answer past because it is describing events that took place in the, that take place in the future of this. They sacrificed to demons, not to God, to gods they did not know, to new gods, new arrivals that your fathers did not fear. Doesn't that seem like it's looking backward? Of the rock who begot you, you're unmindful and forgotten the God who fathered you. The Hebrew there, fathered you, is really probably more related to a mother giving birth. I think it has its root twisting out or something. Maybe a literal picture of birth giving. Do you see past tense there? All right. When the Lord saw it, he spurned them because of the provocation of his sons and daughters. He said, I will hide my face from them. I will see what their end will be. For they are a perverse generation. They've provoked me to jealousy by what is not God. They've moved me to anger by their foolish idols. I will provoke them to jealousy by those who are not a nation. I will move them to anger by a foolish nation. There's so many parallels. Yeah, Bill, you want to...
So, well, no, I have a question. Because like, we keep doing the past, but the 31:20 is obviously, I mean, referring to something that's going to happen in the future. And even like some of the things he's mentioning here.
Yes,
like,
but, so, sorry, stop. So 20 says, and he said, sometime in the past, he said this future thing, I will hide my face.
And I'm going to be talking about 31:20, whenever he's kind of referencing.
Yeah. Oh, 31:20.
That verse, whatever he's referencing.
Yeah, what I was trying to say is, you read what this says right here, it's almost the same language as in 31:20, which is absolutely in the future.
So, but it's not the same thing?
I think it is. I mean, it's the same words. Y'all see what I'm talking about? Look at 31:20 right quick. When I brought them to the land flowing with milk and honey, it's where my fathers filled them. They were grown fat and filled themselves and grown fat. Then they will turn to other. See, that's telling them about the future, right? And yet over here, he's saying this is what happened. Right. Okay, so there's a jealous answer and response. When he saw it, he says, I will hide. So he's looking forward kind of to the future. I think, I'm not sure I didn't have a different multicolor there. This is no good for Bill already. So I will heave. I'm jumping now to 23. I will heave disasters. I will spend my arrows. I will also send. What tense is that?
Future.
Going future. And then 28. They are a nation void of counsel, nor is there any understanding in them. Oh, that they were wise, that they could understand this, that they could understand how this all is. So what is that? I think that's present, but it's kind of a statement of quality. Of what they are in this future time, perhaps, right? Okay, let's keep going. 34, is not laid up in store with me, sealed up in my treasures. Vengeance is mine and recompense. Their foot shall slip in due time. What do you think? Not hard. Future. And then 36, the Lord will judge his people, have companion, so on and so on. Future again. Okay, and then 39, there is no God beside me. That's future. Keep going. And if I wet my glittering sword, I will render vengeance on my enemies. Verse 41. I will make my arrows drunk with blood and so on. And finally, there's this rejoicing. So if you look at this, it seems like this is written from a place in history where are we? Can you
can you fuzz up your eyes and think about this? What has happened in the past and what has not yet happened in the future? Based on where this song appears to be set in time.
Nothing.
What's that?
When you say just...
I know this is kind of complicated. Moses is doing this in his life. Probably the day he died, he's saying these words. That's when it was all said. But it's describing a story, and it takes a point of view that's somewhere, that's before some stuff and it's after some stuff. Can you figure out from where this would be?
In a lot of ways, it seems like they rebelled against God. God has punished them, but He hasn't redeemed them.
Yeah,
but He will.
Yeah. So, yeah, right. So I don't know, is it Syrian captivity, is it Babylonian, who knows, but it's somewhere out there where things are pretty bad, and he's hoping that at some point they'll become repentant and he will save them. And not only them, but others too. Do you see that? So I think, now, has this ever happened before that prophets talk about things as if they've already happened in the Old Testament? Does that happen again in other prophets? Yeah, I think it does. So it's interesting to me that Moses, I think, is taking a view. He's already been told, by the way, you're going to die and they're going to go to apostasy. That's going to happen. So he already knows that. So in some ways, he's telling the story from right around in here somewhere where God's jealous anger, his response happens, and then they may or may not repent. Looks like they will. And so that's what he's doing. I don't want to make too big of a point about that. Just to say, this is not written from the point of view of where Moses stands in time. Okay? We did this already.
So in kind of thinking ahead and thinking of like for those three or four things, and what captivity? So what do you think? Do you think it's Assyria? Do you think it's Babylonian? Or do you think it's sin? I mean, like, is he even kind of looking further ahead?
He is, of course. We're going to talk about that. You know that from the New Testament references. Good question, and we're not going to have time to finish it. But yeah. So take a look at this. Have you ever heard these words before? They have provoked me to jealousy by what is not God. They've moved me to anger by their foolish idols. I will provoke them to jealousy by those who are not a nation. I will move them to anger by a foolish nation. Do you see the parallels here? Foolish idols, not God, not a nation, provoked to jealousy, moved to anger. Do you see those in there? And there's like this mirror, image of what's happening. Have you heard those words before anywhere? How about those who are not a people? You ever heard of that before? Yeah, Hosea. In fact, I think he had to name one of his kids like that. A son, maybe, something like that. She'd weaned Lo-Ruhamah. She conceived more son. God said, call his name Lo-Ami, for you are not my people. That's when it happened, among other times, but that's a place. And I will not be your God. It will come to pass in this place where it was said to them, you are not my people. I wonder where that was, right? There shall be said to them, you are the sons of the living God. Interesting. He's looking forward. The children of Judah and Israel shall be gathered together and appoint for themselves one head. They shall come up out of the land, for the great will be the day of Jezreel. So that's Hosea. Have you ever heard it in another place? What if God, wanting to show his wrath, which he promised he would to the Jews, and make his power known, endured with much long suffering these vessels of wrath, which were prepared for destruction? We know who he's talking about now from Moses' words. That he might make known the riches of his glory on vessels of mercy, which he prepared beforehand for glory. Even us, whom he called, not of the Jews only, but also the Gentiles. As he says in Hosea, I will call them my people who are not my people, her beloved who is not beloved. It shall come to pass in the place where it was said to them, you are not my people, there they shall be called the sons of the living God. Paul makes the argument that this destruction, punishment of the Jews, was really in the plan, and making them jealous by the calling of Gentiles, so that now all, both Jews and Gentiles, will be called into God's fellowship and become sons of the living God. Isn't it? You see this? And you see the image of sonship now is related to that fat brat, Jeshurun, right, who was the son, and he got kicked out of the nest, and he was fed and made fat, and then he just trampled God's will. But he's a vessel of wrath. But still, God says, I'm making a plan out of this. And then on into chapter 11, I say then, have they, the Jews, stumbled that they should fall? Certainly not, but through their fall, to provoke them to jealousy, salvation has come to the Gentiles. You see those phrases, they're all from chapter 32. If their fall is for the riches of the world, their failure riches for the Gentiles, how much more their fullness, meaning they can come back in. Right? And so I speak to the Gentiles, and I magnify my ministry. If my enemies hunger, provoked to jealousy, those are my flesh, that is Jewish people, and save some of them. They're being cast away as the reconciling of the world. What will their acceptance be? So back to Bill's question. This zooms forward to the judgment of God's people, but it's looking in the future of that song poem to say, here's the great redemption of man. That's what he's... And if we didn't think that before, look into these passages, make that pretty clear. Hosea said it's going to happen. Paul says it has happened. So I think that's the picture there. The other theme near the end is this idea of vengeance. And it comes after God's people have been judged by their enemies. In fact, it looks like he's just saying one of them can put to flight 1,000 of them. And they didn't figure that out, that God must have abandoned them. Or they maybe finally did figure it out. They're because they're foolish. But he just says, but vengeance is mine. And I think their foot, if you look at the there in verse 34, three times it's used of the enemies who brought about the vengeance. But here, the enemies, their foot shall slip. That is the ones who brought judgment on God's people, on God's behalf. Right? And then for the Lord will judge his people. And that may mean deliver, right? Or it may mean that he will justly punish them. Probably means both in this case, right? And then you can realize that I will render vengeance to my enemies and repay those who hate me, and render vengeance to his adversaries and provide atonement for his land and his people. Okay, so that's found twice in the New Testament. Once, Paul makes the argument that we don't have to take vengeance, even if we're being persecuted. Do you remember that passage in Romans 12? Let God take care of that. And by the way, he goes on in the very next few verses, which happen to be chapter 13, is in chapter 12, and he talks about what institution that is God's vengeance on evildoers. Remember that? It's the same word he's used again, so I think there's a connection. You leave the vengeance to God, and maybe government is part of that, or maybe enemy nations are part of that. That's kind of what he's saying here. And the other place it's used is in Hebrews. And he says, if we sin willfully after we receive the knowledge of the truth, right? And here's this trampled word again. Of how much worse punishment will we be worthy who has trampled underfoot the Son of God, right? And so what's, now in this case, who's the vengeance on? It's not the vengeance on those who have turned away from it. So the same phrase of both, I think, quoting from the book of Deuteronomy. So really, there's judgment on his people, and then there's vengeance on the enemies, right? Both are covered in Deuteronomy, and then both are used in the New Testament in the same way. So the Song of Moses is made a reference to in the book of Revelation. Can anybody explain that to me? Because we sing our song about the Song of Moses, right? Some about this. Yeah, right. Well, it's what it says. But I don't really know for sure what it is. But as I look in Revelation, in the context is there's this judgment, and I forget, is it trumpets or bowls of wrath? I think it's bowls of wrath or something coming in that section of Revelation. God's pouring out vengeance on the nations, and it looks as if the people who are singing this song are those who have survived or died and now they're victorious in heaven, looking, and they are singing the Song of Moses. And what is the Song of Moses about in the end? It's about God's vengeance and judgment on his enemies. So that may be the idea here. So you get out of here. All nations shall come and worship before your judgments have been manifested. More bowls of wrath. You know, and then in heaven they sing this Song of Moses. So maybe that's the picture. That's the way the song ends, is it? You know what? My people were evil. I found a way to save them, but I'm taking vengeance on them. So maybe that's the idea there. There it is. Back to Deuteronomy 32, it's kind of similar. Rejoice, Gentiles, with the people. He will avenge the blood of his servants, render vengeance to his adversaries, and provide atonement for his land and his people. And that's the end of the song. And that's kind of similar to what's going on in Revelation. Anybody, any other ideas about what the Song of Moses means in that text? That's kind of what I think. I don't know. Only they have to figure. Okay, chapter 33 is in three parts. This general blessing on God's people, which is this section right here, 1 through 5. And then there's the last four or five verses, which is a general section. Both of them make a reference to Jeshurun. Where is it? Right here. This is in the last verse of the introduction and the first part of the conclusion. And in between these two general blessings, what happens? In the middle. I'll give you a hint. The last word of it. Yeah, the end of 5, he says, when the leaders of the people were gathered and all the tribes of Israel together, now unto, and then he starts listing the tribes and going through each of those. You see that? So there's this general thing. And so that's the end of that. We'll come back Sunday. But in your lesson, I'd ask you to kind of go through that, each of the tribal blessings, and we'll talk, finish Sunday, and we'll talk about that. Okay? Questions with that? All right.
Well, I give it up.
So you're going to go over this again?
I'll pick up here Sunday if you want. I really do want to say some stuff about Moses. Right? He's reached the land of corn and wine. And all his riches, holy mine or something, there shines undimmed. Remember, Moses' eyes were undimmed one blissful day when all my night has passed away. O Beulah land, sweet Beulah land, is on thy highest mount I stand. Look away across the sea to mansions that are prepared for me. And you, the shining glory shore, my heaven, my home forever. We don't sing that song. Anyway, Moses was in Beulah land. Yeah. It's not even in her book. I know Beulah Tippin.
We're not supposed to be. My last project is Hotel Fever. It's a song too.